morning is Loparex against the National Labor Relations Board.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Richard Marcus, representing Loparex LLC in this proceeding. May it please the Court, this case is an appeal from a decision of the National Labor Relations Board, and the issues involved in this case that are before the Court are, first of all, whether or not Loparex violated the National Labor Relations Act by promulgating a rule forbidding the posting of notices by employees on the company bulletin boards. The second was telling employees that they could not leave materials on windshields in the company's parking lot. The third is by telling employees they could not leave unattended piles of union materials and union buttons lying in the plant. And the fourth is telling employees who were classified as shift leaders that they were supervisors and therefore that they were not to engage in actions in favor of or to engage in any actions on behalf of any union. I'd like to discuss, first of all, on the notice of the posting on the bulletin boards. The board does not deny in this case that it is legitimate, that it is perfectly legal for an employer to post a notice to that effect, to say that these are company bulletin boards, they are for use by the company and for not for use by employees.
Now, Mr. Marcus, it would be helpful for me if you incorporated in your remarks the standard of review that applies to this court, because I'm looking at both the board's opinion and that of the administrative law judge, which on this point the board relied. And the administrative law judge makes a finding of fact that your client had an anti-union motivation when it announced this new rule. It had not had the rule in the past. There had been other, I'll say, personal or non-company notices on the bulletin boards. And then against the backdrop of several actions, which the ALJ reviews, the new rule gets put into place. So your burden is to show that there is not even substantial evidence to support that.
Well, Your Honor, in part that burden was satisfied by the ALJ himself. With regard to the posting of notices that had gone on, what the ALJ found was that there were posting of notices on one day, and he says it may have been more than one day, but the testimony only shows it was one day.
He says it's unclear. I mean,
Your Honor, there were two employees who testified about the posting, and they both did it on the same bulletin board, and it's clear in the record that that's the case. It is also clear in the record it was on one day, and there is not a scintilla of evidence in the record that anybody from the company saw that.
Because there's also this background of the change of ownership of the company and the on-again, off-again status of Mr. Schillinger. I guess before the administrative law judge is a richer set of facts than one might think by reading your brief.
Well, Your Honor,
it's not just one day a notice goes on and off and then it's suddenly on April the 16th there's this new rule and that's not enough to show it. The administrative law judge is looking at a fuller set of facts about the record.
But, Your Honor, the administrative law judge didn't say that anybody saw it from the company. He said it's probable. And, therefore, it was incumbent upon the company to testify that they didn't see it.
And then he follows on and says, even assuming that this had escaped the respondent's notice, the record demonstrates that there was other pro-union protected activity of which the respondent was clearly aware. And that's when he goes on to talk about Schillinger's union shirt and his button and coats and you know, all of these events happening shortly before the April 16th. It's just not helpful for us for you to invite us to just take a fresh look at the record, because we're not the board.
But, Your Honor, I'm not asking you to judge this whole thing de novo and to take a look at the record from the beginning. What we have asked the court to do is to look at the burden of proof that they have imposed upon the company in this case. He says, the ALJ says, it's probable you saw it. Okay? There was no evidence.
And
then he says, but even if you didn't, even if you didn't, there is evidence of animus. And what we've pointed out in our brief.
You would agree that's a finding of fact.
Pardon?
You would agree that that's a finding of fact.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
But what is the evidence of animus? It was a conversation that took place 2 months previous, and in February of that year, during which Mr. Schillinger raised the issue of union himself. We have one employee who comes to work with wearing a union button and comes to work wearing a T-shirt, and what the board would have you believe is that is enough evidence to establish that there's an ongoing campaign that the employer has to then lay off of any establishing new rules to squelch.
Okay, and, I mean, I think I understand your position on this in any event. I wonder, for me, it would be useful if you would jump ahead to the supervisory status of the shift leaders, because that's something where the board itself has, you can either say, you know, has changed its mind over the years, or maybe that's too strong a statement, maybe it's just emphasized different things. But it looks to me like on this record, most of these teams are about three or four people. And the one person there who is the shift leader has a set of responsibilities, and this board, and I guess we're going to find out sometime down the line whether these two-person boards can speak for the board. Given
we're not contesting that in this case.
I know you aren't. The Supreme Court, however, has now indicated that it's going to visit that issue.
Frankly, so we don't want the new board to pass on this case.
I don't think you do, actually. But in any event, this board, this group speaking for the board, has looked at the set of responsibilities that these shift leaders have and said, we don't think it's enough to meet the test for being a supervisor under the statute. Why isn't that something to which we owe deference?
Before I get to that, and I will get to that in 1 second, I just want to add, with respect to the posting of the notice, I would point out that even the board has now come up with a new theory, and the board's theory is, because the predecessor was had been found guilty of unfair labor practices, that suffices to establish that there was animus. If they're going to consider that, and that's brand new, if they're going to consider that, why don't they consider the fact that this was a different company? This was a company that had relationships with long-standing relationships with unions. So there was no evidence of animus for this company. Yet they tried to impose it from the predecessor.
You pointed that
all right.
Out. Yeah.
So far as the supervisors are concerned, or the alleged supervisors, and we recognize it was our burden to establish that the shift leader were supervisors. There are only two issues that remain with respect to that. We are not contending that they had the power to reward. There was some litigation over that. We have dropped that. What we are relying on are two elements. One is to responsibly direct, and the other is to assign employees. And using the universal camera criterion in terms of whether you sustain the board's theory here, I would ask you to look at the following.
But could I say, I mean that's helpful. That was actually my understanding of your theory at this stage. The facts look like this to me on assignment. We'll take that first, responsibly to direct is the other. It looks like if the company tells the shift leader where somebody's to go, then that prevails. If the company is silent, then the shift leader can say, well, okay, you go over to that machine and you do this task. But I guess the question is that set of facts enough to show power to assign when anytime it wants to, the company can just assume that responsibility itself?
Well, Your Honor, this is sophisticated equipment. This isn't
But I'm talking about a chain of command. I'm not talking about how sophisticated the equipment is. So if the company says Jones is going to go to machine A,
right,
and Smith is going to go to machine B, the shift leader has no authority to override that.
But that's not the case. That was not the case here. The ALJ specifically found, and I don't think the board questions this, that the shift leaders had the ability to assign people to machines, and they did do that.
But what the board realized, here's where we say what Meeker has the authority to do is decide which member of the crew will be used for temporary transfer after someone else decides the transfer will occur, and only if Carson does not designate, Carlson does not designate someone. So,
but that's, Your Honor, that's assignment to out of his department. Within his department, he had the authority to assign people to the machines. What the board relies on, and what the ALJ said that the authority to assign to a machine is not sufficient, and that's contrary to board law. Because that's just a discrete task. What the board says here is that Meeker did not use any sophisticated criteria to determine who went to the machines. He just did it based upon his own conceptions, and they had no gravitas.
Well, some of the shift leaders apparently just let whoever go, and some of them rotated, and some of them actually sat there and thought Jones is better at this machine than Smith is, whatever. I take it there was a variety of practice.
But the important fact is that they had the authority to make those decisions themselves and to select what criteria they would use.
But you still need to interpret that word assign. It seems to me quite easy to imagine, somebody's going to be assigned to filing and somebody's going to be assigned to word processing one day, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we're talking about supervisory responsibilities or some level of minutia that you reach.
Your Honor, the difference between assigning to filing, for example, and assigning to a machine is a critical one for the board. Because
hasn't the board taken its expertise in industrial relations, et cetera, and tried to decide which kind of assignment this was?
There is no question, and the board would admit, I believe, that if all of the shift leaders assigned just to machines, based upon the criteria that Monacan used, the man whose testimony they threw out, that these would clearly have been supervisors. And so to avoid that, they just throw out his testimony and say, well, he wasn't a shift leader by the time of the hearing. I see the light is on. I'd like to reserve whatever time I have for, unless the court has some other question.
Ms. Beard.
Good morning. I'm Heather Beard, representing the National Labor Relations Board. We ask that you enforce the board's order in full in this matter. The Supreme Court has recognized the importance of employee communication in the workplace about unions. And what we have here is a case in which, in a variety of ways, the employer restricted such communication in its workplace. One thing we don't want to forget is the uncontested violation in this case, which the company does not contest and does not go away, which is that the company unlawfully restricted the employees from talking about the union while letting them talk about other issues while at work, which is a clear violation of the act that isn't contested. And that is background for the remainder of the findings in this case. To begin, I just want to touch briefly on the flyers in the parking lot and the buttons that were distributed by the employees and that the company prohibited from doing so. I first would like to correct one thing that my opponent was relying upon in talking about the flyers in the parking lot as having been restricted only because they were putting them on the windshield. A finding of fact by the judge was that the testimony established by substantial evidence that the instructions were broader than simply do not put them on the windshields. Not only were the instructions broader than that, but even had the instructions been confusing to some extent, as the company does a bit in its brief, we have an ambiguity situation here which cuts in favor, rather cuts against the company, because if a rule that is presumed to be unlawful and overly broad is not by the company demonstrated to be a clear revocation of an overly broad prohibition, the company is the one who is unable to demonstrate that they didn't violate the act.
And so isn't the factual circumstance of what was going on at that moment, though, that the man was putting things under the windshields? Maybe what the guy said was, don't hand out union literature in the parking lot, but what he was actually doing, I thought, was sticking them under the windshields.
At the time of that conversation, that's correct. The employees had been walking through the parking lot, and distributing them on the windshields. But the employees also had been handing out the literature. It's unclear exactly what the parameters of handing out are versus putting on the windshields. But I think the board's reliance on the St. Luke's case, which had a very similar set of facts, indicates here the board was well within its reasonable precedent in finding that this was an overly broad rule that was not justified by any business justification that the company could have brought up, and that the littering that the company alludes to in its brief was, as the judge said, wholly an invention of counsel. And so I'd like to go directly to the supervisory findings, what we were talking about before.
To start there, it would help me if you discussed what you think the difference is between the ability to take corrective action and the ability to discipline, and whether you think that the board was drawing the line in a rational way there.
Sure, yes. It is the board's position that the board was drawing a rational line there. As far as the authority to discipline versus the authority to take corrective action, we have to look at what factor that we're looking at in the supervisory test of Section 211. We're looking at the factor as to whether or not we have responsible direction by these shift leaders to be putative supervisors. And in order to responsibly direct, the board looks at what it calls the concept of accountability. And with regard to accountability, there is a clear distinction between employees who are aligned with management and thus able to take corrective action against other employees, and to that extent they're aligned with management, or employees who simply carry out routine directions to employees about different tasks.
So what's corrective action? I mean, is corrective action, you know, the output of this machine is flawed in some respect, there's a quality problem, or you're not producing enough per minute or whatever the machine does? Or is corrective action something like you can put a negative note in the employee's file and institute some sort of progressive discipline system? What are we talking about?
Well, in this case, there was no evidence of any corrective action of either of the types that you just mentioned that any supervisor could take. Now, had there been some evidence in the record that the supervisor could either put a note...
By what you mean, the shift leader?
The shift leader. That the shift leader could have done that, then we'd be talking about a different case. Here, the burden of proof was on the employer and remained as such throughout the course of the proceedings, that they would establish that there was a responsibility to direct. And as part of that test that was set out in Oakwood, the responsibility to direct has, as one prong of the test, the ability to take corrective action, which they're not disputing. There was no evidence of that, of any type of corrective action in this record. And moving on, if I may, to the assignment. I agree with my opponent. The board here did not pass on the authority to assign in this matter. The board found that although there may have been the authority to assign, the authority to assign was not exercised with the requisite independent judgment. And because it was not exercised established that it was an exercise with the requisite independent judgment, in this case, the employer failed at its burden of proof. So when you take a look at Meeker's testimony and you take a look at Monikin's testimony, both of which were considered, what you see here is that each testified about the authority and the exercise of it of each of them only. Meeker about Meeker, Monacan about Monacan. There's no testimony about the independent judgment used or not used by any other supervisor.
And this is a part, of course, about which the board itself writes. This is not
That's
a
correct.
Part where we're going down to Administrative Law Judge Bogus's opinion. So you think we should read this section from the board where they finally say, as to the remaining shift leaders, there is no evidence how they carried out their job responsibilities, and it's actually burden of proof that carries the day.
That's correct. That's exactly what the board's position is in this matter. Mm-hmm. And so when you take a look at what was presented and what wasn't presented, with the burden lying upon the employer in this case, the board reasonably and consistent with all of its precedent found that they did not establish that the shift leaders were supervisors under the Act.
So you would agree. I mean, if the company had had some operating manual or something that said, here's what we expect our shift supervisors to do, assign work to different machines or something like that, so that there was a uniform policy, you wouldn't, in that instance, need to have every single shift supervisor march up and testify.
Oh, absolutely not. You can make inferences from the testimony of one or more shift leaders, certainly. But here, when the burden is on the employer and there's no evidence that any of that assigning to machines involved independent judgment, I mean, the board has made distinctions between sort of routine and clerical tasks, assigning, as I believe Meeker testified, I'd randomly put someone here. Sometimes I would let someone who had been on it before be here. That, although that might be assigning, it's certainly not with the requisite independent judgment. And so there certainly could have been testimony in this case that the employer would put on to meet its burden, but it simply did not. And I'd like to also just very briefly address the bulletin board issue that was talked about in my opponent's case. I think the key here is a substantial evidence test, and I wanted to correct one other thing. The board did not find that simply because Mr. Schillinger wore union buttons that therefore the company forever had to justify everything that it did. That certainly isn't the standard that the board has. The board found that under the totality of the circumstances, in the context of Mr. Schillinger's...
That, of course, is not a standard at all. It's just a verbal formula for saying we don't actually have a rule here. We make it up as we go along.
The totality of the circumstances? Well, respectfully,
that's the way lawyers deny having or applying any rule.
Sometimes lawyers do that. However, I don't think that here the totality of the circumstances of the animus and the actions that were taken in this case, it is just sort of a rhetorical flourish. I think that it's clear that we have the test that the board applied was this rule was not promulgated until there was union activity that the company did not approve of and vocally told Mr. Schillinger it did not approve of. And then once these posters were posted on the bulletin board and they were removed, all of a sudden there was a new rule that came about. And the precedent that the board looked at was the Jordan Marsh case, which shows that if you promulgate a new rule and you do it in these kinds of circumstances, if the employer cannot establish a neutral reason, then there has been a violation of the Act.
So in other words, you're really just saying that there's enough predicate evidence to justify the administrative law judge's inference that there was anti-union animus in the promulgation of that rule. I mean, he can't just look at the rule on its face and know that, because it would be a perfectly lawful rule in some circumstances.
That's correct.
But he needs to find reasons to think that this particular one isn't.
That's correct, given the predicate evidence and the reasonable inferences drawn. That's absolutely the board's position.
Okay.
I see that I do have a little more time left, but unless anyone has any other questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beard. Anything further, Mr. Marcus?
Just a couple of comments, Your Honor. First of all, the question that you asked about taking corrective action. Specifically, what counsel has just said is if you act as a supervisor, then you take corrective action. And I would say that putting into somebody's file that they made mistakes, unless that goes somewhere into a round file where nobody ever looks at it, that is the basis of supervisory action. Because
well, I guess your argument, though, was that it was that there was a necessary congruence between the ability to take corrective action and the ability to discipline. And I wasn't so sure of that, because it seemed to me you could just say to somebody, look, you know, speed up your work on this machine a little bit, and that's where it would end, you know, and so you're correcting the employee's work performance, but you aren't in some punitive way, you know, disciplining the employee.
Your Honor,
so I thought there was some difference.
The corrective action concept is one that really, really doesn't belong here. We're talking about accountability to establish independent judgment, and this record is replete with evidence that shift leaders were penalized for mistakes made by the people that they were. They lost pay. They were suspended for actions.
But the board thought that was penalized for their own failures as opposed to for the failures of those under them.
That's because they disregarded the evidence which showed that there were – no, they disregarded the evidence that showed that there were several employees who were penalized for the actions of the people who had worked for them.
Suppose at a local McDonald's, the manager tells all the workers, you're responsible for everything that goes on here, so if you see somebody else burn the hamburgers, tell them to stop. Would that make every member of the workforce a supervisor?
Certainly not. Why
is what the shift leaders do here any different from my hypothetical?
Because what they are using the right to take action, that is a subset to show that you are responsibly, quote, directing them, or that you have accountability for their direction.
Did you watch the Monday Night Football game last night?
I missed it, Your Honor.
Oh, too bad. You would have seen the quarterback direct the lineman to block a particular linebacker, and I wonder if, on your view, that makes the quarterback a supervisor.
I really would not venture.
Okay.
Probably why.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.
He does get paid.